No, sé, lo chile.
Representative Laban, Representative Pelton, Vice Chair Ortiz, and with us is Representative Josephson and Representative Merrick. We also have online Speaker Edgman and Representative Wall and Representative Drummond. Also online, we have Commissioner Mahoney, Devin Mitchell, Colleen Glover, Ann Stickle, Alexi Painter, Mike Barnhill, and Bill Milks. Before we start today, we are understanding that we have some technical difficulties, and there might be points where...
The meeting of the Finance Committee to order.
where we might lose everybody. If we do, we'll take a brief at ease until everybody can call back in, and I apologize if that happens. Today, the committee will hear updates from the Department of Law on recent Supreme Court decisions regarding the oil and gas tax credit bonds, Department of Revenue on state revenues, including the impact of the bond decision, and finally from the Division of Legislative Finance on state fiscal solutions. Just a reminder, I ask that everyone calling in to please make sure their phones are on mute so we do not have any background noise. We'll let each of the presenters go through their presentations, and then we'll take questions when they're done. And we will begin first with the Department of Law. We have Assistant Attorney General Bill Milks talking about the recent Supreme Court decision. Mr. Milks, will you put yourself on the record and start your summary?
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
This is Representative Carpenter. I just needed you to know that I'm online as well.
Okay, thank you. And we also have, we've had Senator Gray Jackson, Representative Jackson, and Representative Carr also join us.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Bill Milks. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law. And I was going to today, at the request of the committee, give a short update on a Supreme Court decision that was issued on September 4. That's the 4 versus State of Alaska case. So the background of this case is that it concerned legislation, HB 331, that was passed by the legislature in 2018, introduced by the Governor Walker. And what it sought to do was to address outstanding oil and gas tax credits that had accumulated, and proposed a financing structure in which a corporation, state corporation, would be created. That corporation would issue bonds, and that the proceeds of the bonds would be used to pay off outstanding oil and gas tax credits, and the debt service for the bonds would be subject to legislative appropriation. So the debt service would be paid by legislative appropriation, but there was no binding requirement that the legislature appropriate the money. So the sort of more general background of this is that it, of course, concerned the oil and gas tax credit program that began in the first part of the 2000s and, importantly, in 2003, 2006. A program was established that provided that tax credits could be used to reduce production tax, or they could be sold to another producer so they could use them to reduce their tax liability, or the tax credits could be to the Department of Revenue for purchase of those tax credits, subject to legislative appropriation for money to pay to purchase them. And this was all part, of course, in a concept to try to encourage production and spur job growth. So then once the oil pricing system plunged in 2014, then for that time, for the first time, the appropriations to pay for the tax credits were reduced. They were reduced by a veto by the governor at that time, and then the legislature eventually phased out the program in 2017, but there were still outstanding oil and gas tax credits that at the time the governor proposed HB 331 in 2018 and the legislature passed that legislation. There was an accumulation of outstanding tax credits, which was in the neighborhood of $800 million, and it was thought probably another $200 million were still available to be requested. So HB 331 proposed a process proposed to try to essentially refinance those tax credits through the issuance of bonds that would be then paid out, the debt service of the bonds would be paid out over a decade. It was challenged, there was a legal challenge by Mr. Foer quite quickly to the legislation, alleging that it was a kind of debt that's not permitted. It would create a kind of debt not permitted under Alaska's Constitution. The Superior Court dismissed the lawsuit, finding that it was those were constitutional bonds, and that notion was focused on the fact that the full faith and credit of the state were not being pledged. An appeal was filed, and then the Supreme Court on September 4 reversed the Superior Court and reached the conclusion that those bonds of this nature that the legislation would authorize did violate the Alaska Constitution's provision on contracting state debt. And the couple of takeaways on this decision are that the court was faced with a kind of bonds in which a corporation would issue the bonds, but the corporation had no independent revenues to pay the debt service. It was simply going to be subject to legislative appropriation. So the court's decision sort of marks a guiding line on the ability to issue bonds. It does not affect the state's ability, which is clear under Alaska's Constitution, to issue general obligation bonds, which are first approved by the legislature and then the voters for purposes like capital improvements and veterans loans. And it also does not affect the ability of the state or state entities to issue revenue bonds, in which there are, as the court has said, specific, that's a specific authorization under the last constitution for corporations to issue revenue bonds where there's a dedicated revenue stream. So some of the key takeaways are the ability to issue bonds for the oil and gas tax credits payments. The court said you cannot do this under this HB 331 structure. The final point that I would just note is this is a little unusual in that we have a final Supreme Court decision, but the Department of Law did file a limited, what we call a petition for rehearing to the court. And that's because we're seeking the court to just clarify that this case is about the kind of bonds that were before it, which were pretty, in which there was no revenue streams to pay for the bonds, only legislative appropriations, and did not involve other kinds of revenue bonds in which there are dedicated revenue streams to pay for them. That. We're just seeking a limited clarification from the court on that point, but that we did file that request at the beginning, September 28th, so the beginning of this week. And so on that piece, we're waiting for the court clarification on that.
Thank you. Now moving on to questions. I would like to start with Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding moving forward in some manner, has Department of Law looked into a repayment method that might be tied into an escrow approach? And by that I mean, should the legislature authorize a draw from, say, the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve account and set aside for future bond debt repayment an amount that allows for a 10-year repayment. And under that method, the legislature would basically be guaranteeing bond debt repayment from a funding source that's outside the general funding. In essence, it would be taking approximately 1/10 of 1% of the value of the permanent fund, if that value is $65 billion. setting it aside as a commitment to future payment, the dollar amount of about $750 million would then be available, would reassure bondholders that there is a commitment to repay the bonds, and it would not create a problem as far as a general obligation. It would be a revenue stream, in essence, that's connected to, say, the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund. I guess one of the sidebars to this would be, would that be a violation of Senate Bill 26 and the 5% draw? But I guess I would argue that it would not necessarily be funded from the earnings reserve. It would just be a commitment that if the legislature in the future chose not to use general funding, it could fall back on a draw from the earnings reserve. Would you have an opinion about that approach?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative LeBlanc. I don't have an opinion right now. I think, as you can appreciate, these are pretty complex financing structures and that, so I'd have to, you know, confer with the Department of Revenue and pencil all of that out, so I can't offer an opinion about it right now.
And thank you. I expected you would not have an opinion, but it's just a concept I'm pulling out there. Madam Chair, if I could ask a follow-up.
A follow-up?
Yes, do you have an opinion regarding the impact to the state's credit rating if we continue down the path of ignoring repayment? Right now, we are in technical default. If we become in permanent default and we just say as a state that we're not going to honor our commitment to pay these tax credits, what would be the potential fallout from the financial markets of the state defaulting on these obligations?
And Representative LeBlanc, you might save that question for our next presenters.
I respect and appreciate that. I just wondered if there's any opinion from the Department of Law.
Through the chair, Representative, no, I don't have any opinion. I think the Department of Revenue is better able to assess questions like that.
And I respect that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question really is for Mr. Mitchell, and so I don't know if we're at that
point. No, we're not at that point. Okay. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Melz. We will be moving on to our next agenda item and hear an update from Commissioner Mahoney and Dan Stickle, Department of Commissioner Mahoney of Department of Revenue, and Dan Stickle, the Department's Chief Economist. Commissioner Mahoney.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lucinda Mahoney, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And as Madam Chair indicated, joining me this morning and we'll be conducting the presentation is Dan Stickle, our chief economist. Additionally available on the phone is Colleen Glover, our tax director, and Devin Mitchell, our debt manager. We're going to start our presentation this morning with a fiscal update and a follow-up of Mr. Mills' discussion of the tax credit certificates. We're going to specifically provide some historical purchase amounts for your reference, and then provide an update that reflects the remaining tax credit certificate amounts and the statutory payoff rate. And as I've heard here, just the questions that abound about, you know, how we are going to move forward with this debt. You know, it's really important that you understand this information because we all understand it will drive policy discussions and discussions about resolutions moving into the future. Then we'll move on to a discussion about our current revenue outlook, first discussing some of the changes that we've made from our 2020 spring forecast. We'll share a few economic indicators regarding the overall fiscal health of our economy, and then use that to launch into our discussion of the revenue outlook for 2021 in 2022. And then lastly, we'll provide our comments just regarding the uncertainties about our revenue stream, the topics that we think about every day in the Department of Revenue, and the areas that will drive policy decisions in all three levels of government in the near future. Specifically, the uncertainty around the path of the virus and how it affects our global and local economies will be critical to our discussions. The global economy, as you all know, it affects the price of oil, which affects our revenues. The global economy affects our investment portfolios. And just as a point of reference, we were just notified yesterday that due to supply shortages currently occurring on the West Coast, it has resulted in the inventories filling up in Valdez. And so we were notified that Alyeska will begin a proration of 25% of production beginning Saturday at noon, lasting through October 6th. So it's a prime example of what's happening throughout the globe is affecting us pretty significantly here in Alaska. Also, we're going to just talk a bit about the investment volatility. As you all know, the POMV is our largest source of revenue, and just share with you how we are mitigating the risk and how we manage through our largest investment portfolio, which is the permanent fund. And then lastly, we'll talk with you about some of the preliminary, and I want to emphasize the word preliminary, analytics that we've performed to assess the potential revenue impacts if ballot measure one passes. And I want to emphasize again, these are estimates, and they're the ultimate interpretation of this measure will only be determined post-enactment. But our goal was to provide the public and with you all with estimates and information for voters to make informed decisions. Our discussion today regarding ballot measure one will be based on the FAQs that were provided as a part of the public hearing process that occurred last week. So with that, I'm going to turn the discussion over to Mr. Dan Stickel, and we will take questions as they are posed. Thank you. Through the chair, Dan Stickel.
All right, excellent. For the record, my name is Dan Stickel. I'm chief economist with the Department of Revenue. As the commissioner mentioned, we'll start with our presentation with a couple slides on tax credits. Then we'll jump into the update on our revenue outlook and finally talk about some of the areas of uncertainty in the forecast. So I'm looking at slide two of the presentation now. This slide shows a history of the tax credit certificate purchases made each year since FY 2007, which was when the tax credit purchases began. Since FY 2007, $3.65 billion has been spent by the state on credit certificate purchases. Prior to fiscal year 2016, the full amount of eligible tax credits was purchased each year. And in 2016 and 2017, changes to the credit laws set in place sunset provisions for new credits. So the ability to earn new credits has been phased out at this point. As state budget issues intensified, FY16 was the first year that less than the full amount outstanding was purchased, and that's been the case every year since. And fiscal year 2020 was the first year that no appropriation at all was made for the purchase of tax credit certificates. Moving on to slide three, this chart shows a projection of how the outstanding tax credits would be paid off over time if the statutory appropriation is made each year beginning in fiscal year 2022. This is based on the spring 2020 forecast. So this projection, DOR calculates the statutory appropriation based on either 10 or 15% of estimated production tax levied before subtracting any tax credit. When the forecast price is less than $60 per barrel, which is the case for the next several years, the multiplier is 15% of that production tax before credit amount. We estimate that there are $738 million of credit certificates outstanding at the end of fiscal 2021, and 5 million more becoming available for purchase in fiscal 2022, for a total balance of $743 million. This chart assumes that no statutory appropriation is made for fiscal 2021. Per the spring forecast, that appropriation would have been $36 million. The chart assumes that a $40 million statutory appropriation is made for fiscal year 2022, and then the appropriation increases over time based on improving oil prices. Under this payoff scenario, most of the credits would be paid off by fiscal year 2032, with the last $4 million purchased in fiscal year 2033.
Representative Josephson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is now the appropriate time for this question. So, through the chair, Mr. Stickles, you talked about how, for example, anticipating prices below $60, applying the formula, we would have paid in FY21 $36 million. What was the amortization on the bonds had the Supreme Court gone the other direction? I'm trying to figure out the delta between a successful House Bill 331, and an unsuccessful House Bill 331.
Sure. Through the chair, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I'm sure we'd be happy to follow up, or I don't know if Mike or Devin wants to weigh in.
Mr. Mitchell, do you have those numbers?
No, I don't have those numbers at this time, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
It's my sense that in terms of the Treasury, so looking at this just through the lens of our Treasury, is it possible that it's a good thing that House Bill 331 was rejected by the Supreme Court?
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Mahoney. It's really difficult to speculate on something like that, Representative Josephson. I mean, we're really focused right now on trying to really evaluate the impact of the ruling and to manage our way through it. So we can't speculate at this point.
Thank you. And we've also been joined by Representative Johnson at the very beginning of this. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. This is Representative Wohl.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Going back to slide number two, state purchase by fiscal year. If the laws were changed to eliminate cashable credits, it looks like in 2017, but there are still purchases in 17, 18, and 19. What I just want to get a definition of terms here. When you say purchase, because I know there was cashable credits for which the state had to actually pay out to certain oil companies these credits. I thought that was changed so that in going forward, these were simply reduction in taxes received and not necessarily purchases. So maybe I'm just not understanding the terminology. Also, and in 2020, it looks like zero. So are we still incurring more tax credit liability as we go forward, or did it stop when we passed whatever bill that was that eliminated the cashable credits?
Sure. Representative Wohl, through the chair. We are using the term credits for state purchase. Right? The cashable credits is a more colloquial term, but those do refer to the same credits, which are those tax credits which are available for the state to basically write a check to the company and purchase those credits.
Okay.
As far as the timeline goes, there was legislation in both 2016 and 2017 that made changes to the tax credit program. Those bills set in place a gradual sunset for the ability to earn new credits that would be available for state purchase. Those provisions took effect over several years, so we were still incurring some additional credit obligations over the last several years. We, at this point, those credits have been entirely phased out for the ability to earn new credits. We do, in the spring forecast, assume that there will be $5 million of additional credits that become available for purchase in fiscal year 2022, and then at that point, we are forecasting no additional credits that would be available for purchase. So the $743 million balance that we're forecasting to be available in fiscal year 2022 should be the final balance for those credits.
And since we're all calling in, I need to impose everybody as before you begin to speak, could you please introduce yourself?
Madam Chair, may I have one follow-up to that?
A follow-up?
Thank you. And thank you for that answer. That explains it well. So looking at the next slide going forward, where there's sort of basically a repayment schedule starting in 2022 and ramps up to 2032 based on oil prices and that 15% statutory minimum. How does this compare if HB 331 had been not overturned? I know that there was a deal struck with the oil companies that they would take a reduced payment, so to speak, and so our total liability, I guess, would it be about the same because of the fees of the bonding, so that the two numbers, paying through a bond or paying this way over the next up to 2032, is it about the same ultimately for the state?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, this is Dan Stickle for the record. So the concept would be that the net cost to the state would be the same or less. But I don't know if Mike or Devin want to add some commentary to that.
This is Devin Mitchell, the state's debt manager, and I think that the point of Representative Josephson's line of questioning is if the price of oil goes up or down in the future, is there an impact on the deal that might have been struck in the past? And the answer to that is yes, that if the price of oil goes up, then the expected payments under the formula go up in a similar fashion, and therefore the deal that the state struck would be more beneficial to the state than was expected at the outset. If conversely the price of oil goes down, then the deal would be worse for the state than it was at the point that it was struck. The expectation under the legislation was, with the best information available at the point in time that bonds would be sold, that you would be selling bonds at a discount to the expected payments under the projections of the day, and then you would have to wait and see what the future held as far as what the actual results were.
Thank you.
Representative LeBond.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to follow up a little bit on my earlier question, and I guess what I'm trying to determine here is a pathway forward. If we can't sell bonds to immediately pay back the total obligation to the tax credit holders, and if we stretch out repayments, say, over a 10-year basis, like what is shown on chart three, how do we reassure the tax credit holders, the banks involved, et cetera, that repayment is pretty much going to happen that we have committed to repay and that we have set aside through a escrow method on the earnings reserve of the permanent fund the money to pay those installments should there not be the will of the legislature at some future date to fund the repayment from the general fund. And would that be a sign of good faith toward those holders and the banks that at least they could count on being paid and that it's not totally speculative that they would be paid? I don't know if that concept makes total sense, but I'm trying to think of a way forward. Thank you for that opportunity to ask a question.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Mahoney. Those are all really good questions. And we are evaluating all of the options that that we can evaluate to determine a step forward. So I just want to assure you that this is very important to all of us, and it is on the top priority in terms of looking at this. Mr. Mitchell, would you like to comment on the view or the potential view of our investors and the banks and credit rating?
Thank you. Again, Devin Mitchell, debt manager for the state of Alaska. And so the non-payment of the tax credits in the current fiscal year didn't have an immediate reaction from the credit rating agencies. That said, it's a commitment that the state has made that it's failing to fulfill, and there are other examples of similar experience in recent history that are cumulatively a death by a thousand cuts sort of analogy, where they reflect negatively on the state's ability to stand behind their commitments. And if folks have the opportunity to go to Moody's Investors Service, one of the more storied investor and credit rating agencies in the United States, on their lobby wall is a motto or a saying, and it's a man's faith in fellow man, and that's really the basis of debt, is that you believe people are going to stand behind their word, and to the extent we lose that, it reflects in your credit rating.
Yeah, a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Yes. Mr. Mitchell, could it be argued that if we were able to attach repayment to the earnings reserve account in the manner in which I suggested, that bond could be sold to pay those tax credits immediately on the basis that the revenue stream is committed through the earnings reserve, and that should the legislature fail to meet the annual debt service through the general fund, that it could fall back on state savings? Would that be a valid approach?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I think there would be a number of structuring issues that would be difficult to overcome for purposes of issuing a bond in that scenario. I mean, there's prohibitions on the dedication of state revenue, and so if you were looking at appropriating the entire amount that was due to the under the tax credit program to an escrow that was going to be irrevocably pledged to the repayment of those obligations over time, you would have to come, I mean, we would have to think about that, put it on, I think as Mr. Milk said earlier, it's a complex question that would be difficult to answer today, because it's going to require some thought about the limitations that we have as the result of the recent Supreme Court decision and how that might be structured. So I wouldn't say that it's impossible, but there would definitely be some challenges.
Yes, final comment, Madam Chair. We just may be at a point where we need to think outside the box on this if we're in a position where paying those tax credits is now in question, because default by the state on these would be a very bad message to the capital markets and future bond issues, not just by the state, but by municipalities and we don't want to have to damage control that message. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Stickles, for the chair, I think you said on slide three that the statute, had we paid at the statute with these low oil prices, would have required a payment of $36 million. And I know that under 331, we had backloaded the main obligation to pay down the bonds. I guess, although these discussions and questions are vital and important, I'm thinking in terms of a $2.3 billion deficit with a full dividend, they become much smaller in size. Is that fair? And given that the delta between the statute and the bonds relative to this deficit is, it doesn't get us very far.
This is Dan Stickle again for the record, to the chair. So the $36 million that I quoted is what the statutory appropriation for fiscal year 2021 would have been under the spring revenue forecast. When you're looking at the current payoff schedule on slide three, the spring forecast has a lower price point on it than the previous forecast did, and a lower production tax revenue calculation. So this payoff schedule under the spring forecast includes smaller payments and a longer time horizon than what we've been looking at under the previous forecast. So I think if you're comparing to any, you know, previous payoff schedule or what the bonding would have looked like under a previous revenue forecast, that's important to keep in mind.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Our next presenter, Commissioner Mahoney, to you.
Mr. Stickle will continue to do the presentation about the revenue outlook.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure. This is Dan Stickle again. We're now on slide four of our presentation, which is moving on to the revenue outlook portion of the presentation. This slide discusses some of the changes in the world that have happened since we released our spring forecast. The spring forecast was released in early April. It was a time of tremendous and unprecedented uncertainty in the world. A lot has happened since then. The interesting thing is that despite all of the changes, the outlook for unrestricted revenue hasn't actually changed very much at all. Investment revenue is now our most important revenue source. Markets have recovered faster than expected from the March lows. On the federal revenue side, the CARES Act was passed right before the forecast release. It was not included in the spring forecast, but between the state, municipalities, and other entities, there has been about $5.6 billion in federal aid to Alaska. A significant portion of that will be state revenue that will be reflected in fiscal years 20 and 21. That federal revenue is entirely considered restricted revenue in the forecast. On the petroleum side, I'm sure everyone's aware that oil prices plunged in April right after we released our forecast, and actually went negative for one day on April 20th, but then prices headed right back up and are now slightly above the spring forecast level. Oil production was curtailed in April, May, and June, first due to TAPS prorations caused by concerns about oil storage capacity, and then due to low prices, where Conoco chose to reduce production at Kuparuk and Alpine because of unacceptable pricing out there. Those curtailments have ended, but we're still waiting for drilling to come back at Prudhoe and Kuparuk in particular. And finally, on the non-petroleum side, it's been a rough year for tourism and many other industries. We've largely had that baked into the spring revenue forecast. The Federal CARES Act did make some changes to corporate income tax, which will reduce revenue there a little bit over the next couple of years. Moving on to slide five, just to give some context to this revenue update, This slide shows a high-level overview of the fall forecast process, which is just getting started. At this point, fiscal year 2020 data are still preliminary. We'll be looking to finalize those later this month. We're in the process of updating all of our forecast models and assumptions, and we will be working through those for the next couple months. The fall forecast and revenue sources book will be released in early to mid-December, and that will be our next official update to the revenue forecast and will form the basis for the government's budget proposal. Slide 6 shows some key economic indicators for Alaska. While at DOR we focus a lot on state revenue, it's important to also look at how the overall state economy is doing. State GDP, or gross domestic product, was down slightly in the first quarter after 7 straight quarters of gains. The second quarter GDP was released this morning and was down 33.8% for Alaska. Wow. Which is a little more than the national decline of 31.4%. These are, of course, record levels of decline, and COVID obviously had a major impact so far this year on the goods and services produced in the national economy as well as in Alaska. Next, we show the unemployment rate here because it's a widely followed economic indicator, but in this case, it's slightly misleading. The unemployment rate calculation is an estimate of the share of people in the labor force who are out of work and actively looking for work. Some COVID-related issues have complicated the unemployment rate calculation, including the enhanced unemployment benefits, as well as difficulty conducting the survey that helps inform the calculation. So the best read on the employment situation right now probably comes from looking at job numbers and claims for unemployment insurance benefits. The unemployment insurance claims are still nearly 7 times higher than a year ago, and despite the unemployment rate, employment in the state is actually down by 37,000 people, or 10.5% compared to a year ago. Looking at wages and salaries in the state, those are down 6% from a year ago and definitely show an impact of COVID-19. These next two indicators are interesting. Bankruptcies and foreclosures are actually less than the prior year. That's likely due to various government programs that provided some temporary aid and put limits on foreclosures, so we haven't seen the full impact of COVID there yet. And finally, housing starts are down slightly from 2019. A big question here will be what these last three indicators look like over the rest of the fall with federal support and limitations on foreclosures and bankruptcies tapering off. If there isn't further federal stimulus, it's possible that these indicators could start to look really bad, and Alaskans could be looking to the state for help. Now moving on to slide 7 and the current revenue outlook. This next set of slides shows how FY 2020 ended up relative to our spring forecast. An updated view on fiscal years 2021 and 2022. We also include 2 years of history for comparative purposes. For oil price, the FY20 actual average Alaska North Slope price was $52.12. That was slightly ahead of our spring forecast of $51.65. Oil prices plunged in April, and on April 20th, ANS prices were assessed at a negative value for the first time ever. That was the lowest ANS price on records, but then a quick rebound in price in May and June more than offset those April declines. For fiscal 21 and 22, we are showing a revised price outlook based on current futures market prices at the end of last week. For fiscal 21, we're now looking at $42.97 versus a $37 spring forecast. And then for fiscal year 22, we're looking at $45.91 versus a $41 spring forecast. Overall, we're seeing some possible support for oil prices. Global oil demand has rebounded faster than supply since the April lows, and inventories are being drawn down while they're still above historical averages. Absent a second wave of COVID, it looks like we're finding some stability right now. Moving on to slide 9, this chart compares Alaska North Slope average daily oil production to the spring forecast. FY20 production came in at 472,000 barrels per day compared with the spring forecast of 486,000 barrels per day. The production curtailments in April, May, and June caused production to come in below the forecast. And looking forward, drilling of new wells is still on pause in Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk. That definitely impacts oil production. The revised outlook is based on a low oil price scenario prepared by the Department of Natural Resources in April. They've also included actual production so far in FY21. For FY21, the revised outlook is 468,000 barrels a day. That compares to 487,000 barrels a day in the spring forecast. And for fiscal year 22, the revised outlook is 448,000 barrels a day. That compares to 458,000 barrels a day in the spring forecast. We're actively revising this production outlook for the fall forecast. In fact, just this week, we started meeting with companies to understand how their plans have changed since the spring. Moving on to slide 9, this chart looks at unrestricted revenue, not counting the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. FY20 revenue is still preliminary, so we could come in a little higher or lower than forecast once all accruals and reconciliations are complete. But right now, it looks like the state received $1.6 billion of unrestricted revenue, which is pretty much in line with the spring forecast. What happened there is the rebound in oil price in May and June roughly offset the impacts of lower production in April through June. Our revised outlook is based on the revised price and production numbers that I just showed, as well as other known revenue changes. And both fiscal 21 and 22 are looking right in line with the spring forecast, as the slightly higher price offsets slightly lower production and other impacts. So for fiscal year 2021, we're expecting $1.2 billion of unrestricted revenue, and we're expecting $1.3 billion in fiscal year 2022. So it's kind of a good news, bad news story on this slide. While the outlook hasn't gotten any worse, these are still historically low levels of revenue, and the state's fiscal situation remains extremely challenging. Slide 10 shows the – what's your question?
Yeah, this is Representative Wolf. If I could ask a quick question.
Representative Wolf?
So you're basically saying the forecast is almost as predicted because – the price is a little higher than expected, but production is a little lower. Is it fair to say that price is more volatile? So if price were to dip down, production is harder to rebound, especially on the short term. So I guess that's my question, and I think I know the answer. But, I mean, you basically said the good news, bad news makes the prediction accurate, but production being lower than expected, was that is that demand? Is that based on low demand, COVID-related? And do you expect the low demand also to continue as, even if COVID is remedied, that more people are working from home and less people flying for business travel, et cetera, et cetera?
Rep Wolf, through the chair again, Dan Stickle for the record. I think the concern about oil demand is a legitimate concern. We have seen demand rebound faster than supply on a global level. Demand is still not back to the levels that it was before the COVID pandemic, and there's some question about when and if demand globally will return to those levels. As far as Alaska oil production specifically goes, the revised outlook that we showed is based on a low oil price scenario that the Department of Natural Resources prepared back in April and May of this year. And, you know, that scenario was based on the presumption that drilling would be put on pause at major fields. That drilling is still on pause. So I think if you want to understand how oil production might compare to this outlook, you know, paying attention to the announcements that come out of the major fields, Prudhoe and Kuparuk in particular, where drilling has been paused, that would be a a good indicator to look at.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Sure. Moving on to slide 10, this shows the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund. This is now the state's largest source of unrestricted revenue by far. The PONV draw is available for either dividends or government spending. How that split is left up to the legislature to determine. The PONV is a fairly stable revenue source, and it's based on the average ending market value for the first five of the last six fiscal years of the permanent fund. The FY20 actual draw was $2.9 billion. The fiscal year 2021 actual draw is $3.1 billion. And the fiscal year 2022 draw is estimated at just under $3.1 billion. The FY22 draw is actually $21 million higher than what we were expecting in the spring forecast. That was due to a better than expected investment recovery at the end of fiscal year 20, which is the final year that goes into the fiscal year 2022 PONV calculation. I'm on slide 11 now, next we will talk about a few areas of uncertainty impacting the revenue outlook as we head into the fall forecast. Of course, there's always uncertainty with commodity prices and production, but this year we have some additional hurdles to deal with. Let me go through each of these in the next few slides. On slide 12.
Representative Lebon has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking at this coming January, when the 32nd legislature is seated, could we safely predict that there will not be a need for a supplemental budget appropriation, that we're financially more or less on a glide path, that won't be necessary?
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Mahoney. That is too difficult for us to predict at this moment. There's uncertainty, and we can't say.
I guess it'll be a surprise then. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Jefferson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For, I guess, the commissioner on slide 10, Mr. Stickles talked about the stability of the draw, and that is that's sort of the best news, I think, that we have, that it's stable. The Permanent Fund Corporation reports that there's an ERA balance of $10.3 billion. It anticipates, because it doesn't know otherwise, that we'll spend $3 billion from the ERA, and that there's $1.7 billion that's unrealized or unrealizable. If we were to pay the retroactive dividends of $4.6 billion, that would leave $1 billion in the ERA. And I'm curious about whether the department thinks the earnings are enough to get us back to the $3 billion sustainable as shown on slide 10. If that were to happen.
Again, through the chair, I hate to continually say it's difficult to speculate on this. But that will be my response again. I can certainly do the analytics on that by reevaluating the balances and provide a response to you in writing.
Yes, please. Thank you.
I see no other questions. You can continue.
Thank you. This is Dan Stickle again for the record. We're on slide 12 presentation. Obviously, the COVID situation is a huge source of uncertainty. The uncertainty around the pandemic and recovery impact, the uncertainty around the pandemic and potential and current recovery impacts all of our major revenue sources in some way. The potential for investment volatility is a major concern, since that's now our primary source of unrestricted revenue. and that topic gets its own slide on the next slide. Looking to federal revenue, federal stimulus funding through the CARES Act and other programs has totaled $5.6 billion so far. That's really helped put a floor under many parts of the economy, but it's unclear if that support will be extended and what will happen when the federal support ends. Petroleum revenue has been impacted through low prices and demand destruction. A resurgence in COVID cases could cause demand to fall again, and that those low prices definitely threaten the economics of new projects. And finally, on the non-petroleum side, these revenue sources are impacted in several ways. In tourism, we pretty much lost the summer season this past year for cruise industry in particular. We're expecting a slow return to normal. Right now, it looks like we could potentially have a half-capacity season next summer, but that is speculative. COVID has also impacted many of our other basic industries like mining and fishing. The impacts to the basic industry pose an extra challenge because not only do they threaten state revenue, they also directly impact communities and their economic base. And I wanted to specifically mention corporate income tax because that's been impacted in two ways. First, corporate income tax is based on profits, and there's a lot of uncertainty around what those will look like for calendar year 2020. And then the CARES Act made a change to the corporate income tax that allows companies to carry back any losses for the 2018, 2019, and 2020 tax years up to 5 years back. Alaska statutes are tied to the federal law, so we adopt this provision by reference, and we've estimated that this carryback provision will have an up to $200 million impact across fiscal years 2021 and 2022. But that's a very uncertain estimate since we don't know what 2020 losses look like at this point.
Mr. Stickle, this is Representative Johnston. This slide and the previous slide, you have mentioned the federal stimulus funding, the CARES Act funding. And the last time we had this amount of federal funding injected into our economy was during the Exxon Valdez spill. And as we're looking at state revenues, has anybody taken a look back to see if there was any adjustment? Because we have very few ways to get the secondary and tertiary revenues from the federal funding. We don't, unless it affects our corporate tax, and locally it could affect maybe the sales tax or property tax, but with the state, have you looked back to see what effect it had on the bottom line during the Exxon Valdez and see if we could look at that to the effect it would have this year?
Madam Chair, that's not something that we've looked at directly, but that's an excellent suggestion.
Are there any other questions?
I was going to say one of the interesting things about the current federal funding is that it's largely replacing what would have been there in the private economy. So the federal stimulus has come in to replace wages and salaries that were lost through the unemployment benefits and to replace economic activity from the lost tourism season, for instance.
The point is what effect does that have on the bottom line for the state? Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, please proceed.
Sure, this is Dan Stickle continuing with slide 13, discussing investment volatility. As we've seen so far this year, investments can be extremely volatile. At the lows in March, the stock market lost over a third of its value in a single month, but since then, markets have turned around and rallied back to all-time highs. And so investments are inherently volatile. An example is that for large cap stocks, the anticipated return is expected to range from a 10.7% loss to a 24.7% gain, a about two-thirds of the time, and that is really too wide of a range for a budget to be based on, especially when your other major revenue source is based on oil prices. One way to reduce this volatility is through diversification. For example, for fiscal year 21, the permanent fund has an expected return of a 0.2% loss in the low case and a 13.9% return in the high case. So that's a smaller range of uncertainty through the diversification. For comparison, the permanent fund returned a 2% positive return in fiscal year 20. And then for the POMV draw, the investment volatility is further reduced by the way the draw is calculated. The draw is based on an average fund value for the first five of the last six fiscal years. So even with the range of possible fiscal year 2021 returns, which are the volatility is already reduced through diversification, that range of returns don't impact the POMV calculation until fiscal year 2023. And then the potential range on the 2023 draw is only about $50 million.
And just for clarification, I think we closed out this year with a 2% return. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. For the permanent fund, the net return for fiscal year 20 was 2%.
And as we look at the stability of our percent of market value draw, we, with the look back, it goes, the hopeful anticipation is a 7% return over the five-year look back, correct?
Madam Chair, the 7% was the expected return baseline assumption from Cowan Associates
that goes into
the permanent fund calculation.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, please continue.
Chair, again, Dan Stickle, and I'm on slide 14 of the presentation now. The last area of uncertainty we wanted to highlight is ballot measure one, which would make changes to the oil and gas production tax. The information on these slides is taken from an FAQ document that we prepared in conjunction with the public hearings conducted by the Lieutenant Governor last week. For our modeling, we used one potential interpretation of the ballot measure based on how the sponsor has described the initiative, and want to make it clear that this is not a final interpretation and is subject to change. Our modeling assumes that ballot measure one, I may use the acronym BM1, but the ballot measure one provisions would apply to the Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and Colville River units. And for these units, the minimum tax would be increased to at least 10% of gross value. All per barrel credits, carried forward losses, and other offsets would be prohibited. And there would be an additional net profits tax that would take effect at higher oil prices. The ballot measure would necessarily increase state revenue and decrease producer profits. At this point, we have not attempted to evaluate the net impacts of the revenue increase compared to changes in oil production and the economy, but we do know that some companies are delaying decisions pending the outcome of the election. Slide 15 shows estimated production tax revenue for fiscal year 2022 under current law and ballot measure one at several different oil prices. This analysis is based on the spring forecast assumptions, assuming no changes in oil production and company investment as a result of the tax change. The revenue impact depends on the oil price. At a $35 oil price, ballot measure one is expected to bring in $224 million of incremental revenue, which is a 216% increase in production taxes. At $75 oil price, ballot measure one is estimated to bring in just over $1 billion of incremental revenue. That represents a 223% increase in production taxes. And again, keep in mind that these estimates do not factor in any potential changes to oil production or investment. Slide 16 provides a little bit different look. This is an estimate of how profits from oil production are shared between the different stakeholders at different prices. This analysis, again, is based on the spring forecast assumptions for fiscal year 2022, and this analysis is looking just at those three units that we're showing is impacted by ballot measure one. The government and producer take calculations look at the profit that is left over after accounting for transportation costs and lease expenditures and the share of that profit that goes to the state, federal government, and producers. At $35 per barrel, under current law, the state's revenue is actually higher than the profit per barrel, so the state take is greater than 100%, and the producer take is negative. In this example, costs for the impacted fields amount to about $30 per barrel, so there's only about $5 per barrel of profit, and the state takes a little more than that. Under ballot measure one, at $35 per barrel, the government take increases to 140%, and the producer take goes even more negative. At higher prices, under ballot measure one, the producer take does go positive. At $45 oil price, the total government take is 70% with a 30% take to the producers. And at $75 oil prices, the total government take is 62% with 38% of the profit to the producers. And again, these estimates do not factor in any potential changes to oil production or investment.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Stickles. The difficulty I'm having with the chart at page 16 is I can't tell, and I understand it's you know, it's an 8.5 by 11 page, and you've got limitations, but I can't tell what the producer take is at these other prices under SB 21, only at $35 a barrel. So I don't know. I see that the department has a position about the total producer, or rather the total government take, vis-a-vis producer take, but I just can't compare it to much. On the chart.
Sure, Representative Josephson. So we'd be happy to follow up with that information, but under the same example, for instance, at $45 per barrel under current law, we would be looking at a 39% producer take. At $55 a barrel, it would be a 49% producer take. At $65 per barrel, it would be a 52% producer take. And at $75 a barrel, it would be a 50% producer take. So obviously, there's a significant difference between the two laws.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Ortiz. I have a question.
Okay. Representative Josephson has a follow-up.
Just a quick question or comment. Mr. Stickles, The consideration you've made that we can't know how producers would respond if ballot measure one passed, I mean, there are many variables on their plate, including obviously price, and those are not entirely in their control. Isn't that right?
Representative Josephson, that's correct. But we've not attempted to predict what the response to be. That would be speculation at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stickle, going back to the producer take under Senate Bill 21, you mentioned under current law what the take would actually be if ballot measure one didn't pass. Can you tell me anything about how the producer take under Senate Bill 21 compares where producers have production in other states or other regimes? In other words, are we under Senate Bill 21, is the producer take generally higher or lower than other tax regimes, or can you tell me about that?
Sure. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, under current law, and there have been some third-party studies that have done the comparison to other tax regimes, we'd be happy to point the committee to some of those studies. My understanding is that Alaska is competitive under current law with other tax regimes as a general point.
Thank you.
Follow up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Excuse me for my naivety, but what is the federal take that begins at 45 dollars per barrel?
Yeah, Madam Chair, what we're showing there is the federal corporate income tax.
Oh, okay.
At the current marginal tax rate of 21%. And the reason that you don't see that at the $35 per barrel price range is because there is no profit to the company to be taxed at $35.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, is that the end of your presentation?
It is, Madam Chair. We'd be happy to take any broader questions this time.
Are there any other questions before we move on in our agenda? Thank you very much, Commissioner, and for your department, Dan Stickle. Let's move on to Alexi Painter, Director of Division of Legislative Finance. Mr. Painter, could you please put yourself on the record and start your presentation?
Hi. For the record, Alexi Painter, the Legislative Fiscal Analyst. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. So going on to slide two, and I apologize that the page numbers are very small. We're going to be discussing the outlook for fiscal year 21 and fiscal year 22. But first, we have to look back at fiscal year 20, which just completed. Actual expenditures and revenue will not be finalized until the release of the comprehensive annual financial report of the state. So at this point, all FY20 numbers are kind of in draft form. One of the questions we get a lot is, with FY20 over, what are the prospects for the CBR balance going forward? And unfortunately, we can't really rely on just looking at the cash balance of the CBR anymore and extrapolating from that. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that over the past few years, we've made increasing direct appropriations from the CBR, such as for last year's capital budget and for a portion of this year's operating budget. And because those can be drawn out over several years for the capital projects, looking at cash doesn't quite capture that. The other factor is that as we've gotten lower in the CBR balance, the amount of cash in the general fund at the end of the fiscal year that really belongs to the CBR is becoming a more important factor in the balance, and that's a really variable number that we don't really know until we get the CAFR later in the year. However, there is in cash right now about $1 billion in the CBR, so I expect that the final number at the end of this fiscal year will be lower than that. However, it likely will be a little higher than the balance we have in our fiscal summary, which is just shy of $600 million. So, you know, looking ahead, that's probably the reasonable range that we can expect that to end up.
And, Mr. Painter, just for clarification, in the CAFR, as far as the revenues and expenses, it does not include the supplemental for the year, right?
Madam Chair, the CAFR does include supplementals that were spent in that fiscal year, so it's all expenditures of the state in that fiscal year, regardless of the year that they were appropriated.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Chair, Mr. Painter, and Mr. Painter, congratulations on your job, and thank you for returning to the agency. My question is part of the reason the balance is higher, I mean, I assume part of the reason is because of the April 7th vetoes left $200+ million in the CBR, is that right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that is factored into our fiscal summary. So the $600 million or $586.9 million projection includes those vetoes. So the primary reason it's looking to be a little higher than that projection are lapse. We know that, for example, we had a mild fire season, so some of the fire supplemental that we gave lapsed to the general fund. And the other reason is that deposits to the CBR appear to be a little higher than the forecast, although that will get finalized. But it looks like we may be a little better off than we thought, and we'll have a better idea of that once FY20 numbers are finalized.
Sorry, Lexi, one more question. As far as the CBR, our understanding this spring that we basically look at $550 million, give or take, to be used as the cash resource for our budget. Is that correct?
Yes, that depends on the year. So at the end of fiscal year 19, the general fund ended at a pretty high balance, and so there was about $500 million from the, that belonged to the CBR, truly, that was in the general fund at the end of fiscal year 20 for cash flow, or sorry, fiscal year 19 for cash flow. Fiscal year 20 ended up at a very, at a much lower level of cash, and it's possible that when we get the final numbers, the CBR will actually owe the general fund. So yes, we use about $500 million for cash flow, but how that ends up at the end of a fiscal year is highly variable. We've had very large swings in that from year to year based on kind of cash management needs. So $500 million is an average, but it has been higher and lower in different years.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Josephson?
On that topic, and for those listening in, through the chair, Mr. Painter, the football term, the red zone, which means something different, but here we are sort of in a red or danger zone, are we not? I recall the Treasury Division saying they didn't like a balance anywhere near the number that we have or that we're projected to have in the CBR.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, the impact of going below this level in the CBR is really that what we've been doing in the past few years is drawing from the CBR first before going to the POMB draw, and that allows the Permanent Fund Corporation to maximize investment earnings. As if we don't have a CBR and we have to use that POMB draw first, then that will cost us investment revenue. And so it's not that it's unmanageable, but it's costly because the permanent fund earns 7% a year. The CBR itself is in much shorter term investments. So it's really just losing out on some higher return investments because we'd have to use our POMB draw earlier in the year.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lebon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Painter, do you have a crystal ball prediction for what we might face in January for the 32nd legislature when it's seated on any potential supplemental needs for the budget? A couple years ago, we needed to deal with a extreme fire season and the Anchorage earthquake, the economic fallout from those events. Do you have any prediction about what we might be facing in January due to COVID-19 and other issues that might befall the state in the next fiscal year?
Representative LeBron, through the chair, the next few slides I'll be going through some of the potential supplemental issues, and at this point it's very difficult to put a number on some of them, and I'll explain that as we go, but yes, there are several areas that we're seeing potential for supplemental needs, and I'll go into that in the next few slides.
Then I'll be patient. Thank you.
Okay, if there's no more questions, we'll move on to slide 3, where we'll start getting into some of the potential supplemental needs. So slide 3 points out that in FY21, we have an incomplete capital budget at this point. The majority of what we would consider kind of a typical capital budget from the past few years, where we've had federal match and not a whole lot else, the majority of that was contained in the operating budget this year as we tried to get out of session quickly. And then additional RPLs were approved in August that added some of the missing capital projects. However, there's still a pretty large chunk that's outstanding. So we looked at the governor's capital budget submission and compared it to what we've passed so far and found that there's about $150 million of projects that the governor had requested that have not yet been funded, and about $33 million of that is UGF. And so some of that may be policy choices to not fund things that the governor requested, but some of the items that haven't been funded are sort of normal big-ticket items that we put in every year, such as deferred maintenance, the Alaska Energy Authority projects like the bulk fuel program. And then many agencies have very little of their capital budget funded, such as Fish and Game and Department of Natural Resources. So those agencies and those projects are at this point unfunded. And if we wait and just skip a year on some of those, it would mean probably missing the 2021 construction season for deferred maintenance, for example. If we don't pass those until April or May, it would be very difficult to get that spent quickly. So for a lot of these projects, the earlier we can appropriate it, the better. We've already kind of missed the first deadline because the federal fiscal year ended earlier this week. We don't quite know how much federal money we lost because of that, but we may get a better idea by the time we get into session, but not appropriating some of these before that probably did cost us some federal revenue. Hearing
Mr. Kaner, I think when we were going through this process this spring, there was quite a bit of discussion about this. And one of the things we learned from our federal delegation is that there are lapsed funds from other states that we could take advantage of, maybe. And I guess my caution is that other states are in bad or worse shape than we are. So hopefully this won't mean that these matching funds won't be available.
Madam Chair, that's a good point. I think with it will really vary by grant, and so the picture of how much we lost from not having that federal authority or that match in place is unclear at this point. And I think as the administration goes through its budget development process, I'd expect that they'll try to get some more information about that by the time we're back in session. So moving on to slide four, we'll cover some of the emerging budget issues in FY21. As Representative LeBon mentioned, there are some agencies that have lost significant revenue due to COVID-19 and may need supplemental appropriations. I think the most prominent of that is the Alaska Marine Highway System. The department has estimated about $45 million of lost revenue between fiscal years 20 and 21 and has responded with a drastically reduced schedule. However, they may still need additional funding in order to get through the year and pay for the required vessel overhauls. There are other agencies that are relying on fees or designated taxes, such as Fish and Game and, to a lesser extent, DEC. And some of those may have shortfalls, and I think knowing whether they can just make that up out of carry forward or other things or not is something that we'll have a better idea of by the time we get to session, but it's very possible that we could see some agencies that have shortfalls. And then another large one, potential supplemental item, is that school district enrollment is down in many districts. There's been quite a few news articles about that. And one thing, I want to emphasize a few things about that. The first is that the October student count will make the scope of this issue much clearer. That count actually began this Monday and goes for 4 weeks. Once we get the numbers from that, I think it'll be much easier to see exactly how much enrollment is down in different districts and what sort of fiscal impact that'll have on these districts. So we should have a much clearer idea in the next couple of months. And the other thing, there's actually I got my months wrong in this slide, but for the first 9 months of the year, districts receive payments from the state based on last year's student count, and only the last quarter of payments depend on the new student count. So no matter how the student count comes out, they're still getting a solid stream of revenue until April. And at that point, if there are revenue declines, they will start to feel it then. So there, if the legislature desires to address this during session, there will be some time before the districts are actually seeing that impact. The other thing I want to highlight that I think doesn't get talked about a lot is that we do have a statutory hold harmless provision for reduced enrollment. A district that experiences a 5% enrollment reduction gets to keep 75% of the difference between last year's enrollment and this year's enrollment. While some of the headline numbers about being down 10% in students is alarming, that would trigger the hold harmless and they would keep 75% of the difference between the 2 years funding. That's not to say that's not a significant funding loss, but it may not be as severe as just doing the straight line math. And there may be districts that lose just shy of 5% that are actually worse off than a district that loses exactly 5%. So there may be some equity issues that the legislature might want to address. But again, once we have the student count, it'll be much clearer which districts are falling into the hold harmless and which aren't, and what exactly the budgetary impact will be.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
And so do I, Madam
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Painter, on that last topic, so you're saying if school enrollment is down in October, which I imagine they are all across most districts, and certainly in my area they are, more than 5%, you're saying that they're going to use last year's numbers for the first 75% of the year. So that would mean that next year they would be going off this year's numbers. So even if school is fully open next year and enrollment is back up, they will be going on this current year's number, so they would be taking a cut next year based on this year's attendance?
Representative Wall, through the chair, their early payments would be reduced, and then their true-up payments in the last quarter of the fiscal year would get them to their total amount. So that may cause some cash flow issues for districts if their enrollment rebounds next year and they're getting reduced payments throughout the first three quarters. But at the end of the year, it would true up.
Okay. So they'd be made whole at the end of the year to make up for the first three quarters of the year that are low because they're based on this year's numbers, I guess is what you're saying. And if it goes below greater than 5% enrollment loss, then there's a mechanism to have the 75% of the difference between the 2 years. So it's not as bad as it may come out. And also other agencies, I mean, would you include the university as one that's going to see a significant decrease in funding due to COVID-19? Would that be, in the category with the Marine Highway and Fish and Game and so on?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, yes. The university has said that they have significant tuition decreases, although I think the latest numbers are a little less than their original projections. It is still a significant loss for them.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Ortiz. I have a question.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Painter, in relationship to school district enrollment and the variables, I understand the variables, and we're really waiting for an October student count. But is there, what I'm trying to get a handle on, is if there is a need either for a supplemental and or some sort of increase in funding in FY22 to make, quote, districts whole. Can you give me any idea what kind of variable monies we're talking about? Because, on the Alaska Marine Highway, you say revenue is down by $45 million. But on the school district portion of the slide, we're only talking about percentages of enrollment, and that's hard for me to equate to actual potential dollars that the state would be asked for in relationship to a supplemental or further funding in the next year?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it is very difficult to put numbers on that because we really don't know which districts will trigger the hold harmless and which will not. And so, you know, if you have a bunch of districts that come in with a 4.5% revenue enrollment decline, that would be a very different situation than if you have a bunch of districts who have, you know, a 5% enrollment decline and trigger the hold harmless. So because of that kind of hard point, it's very difficult to project the scale until we have the student count. And on
Thank
the Marine Highway point, one thing I would emphasize is that they because of the schedule reductions and they were able to get some CARES Act money for the Marine Highway as well, the supplemental need will not be the full $45 million. It'll be somewhere significantly less than that, but I think the department will come out with their proposal for that when in the governor's budget, so I don't want to speculate on that amount at this point. Okay, seeing no further.
Yes, please proceed. Thank you.
Madam Chair, so Representative Carpenter, I have a question.
Oh, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, Alexi, thanks for joining us today. And I have a question concerning some discussion with the local school district regarding submitting numbers, student count, based on previous year's counts. Can they do that currently under the current law? And if not, would it require a change in statute to allow them to do that?
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, the department does not have that flexibility under current law. The department has to distribute money according to the formula and statute, and the only flexibility, they really don't have any flexibility in their administration of that. So it would take a statutory change. We could try in the budget to concoct some sort of complicated language that would accomplish the same thing, but a statutory change would be much, much cleaner. And it would be highly preferable to trying to backfill with an appropriation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I had for now.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to slide 5, we have a couple more emerging budget issues. So as we've heard in a few venues at this point, a significant portion of the CARES Act money flowing through the state is unspent at this point. Particularly, some local governments have been slow to receive and spend their funding. The state small business grant program had a slow start, but now applications have actually, if all of them were approved at this point, the funding would be exhausted. And then the other part that's not on the slide is the portion of money going through the health and social services budget for use in other state agencies, and that also has been allocated largely but not all spent, and we only have a few more months to do that spending. So one outstanding question is what happens if there's money remaining at the end of the year. I think there was some expectation earlier that the federal government might extend the deadline or change some of the rules. It's unclear what exactly will happen with that and what exactly will happen if there's money left over from any of these allocations. Some have speculated we could use it for the unemployment trust fund to shore that balance up. That could happen, but I think there's some questions about whether the administration could do that without the legislature or not. And so I think that's just an unknown at this point about what will happen with remaining funds. Another supplemental item, this is a pretty minor one, is that the election fund will need an appropriation out to the Division of Elections early in the next calendar year. We were able through the RPL process to get federal funding into the election fund to be used for this fall's election, However, the RPL process cannot be used to get money out of the election fund. So essentially they're spending more from the fund than they would be able to do under the current appropriation and will need some sort of supplemental to be able to keep operating throughout the full year. Some good news is that we had a mild fire season. We lapsed funds in FY20, and there's about $11 million left for the second half of this fiscal year. So we're, depending on the forecast for next year's fire season, we could be looking at a small supplemental or possibly none at all, which is certainly a big difference from last year. So that's perhaps a positive we can take. And one thing just to caution here is that when we did the CBR vote in House Bill 205, there was no what we call headroom, which is essentially, you know, space for future supplementals without taking another three-quarters vote. So any future appropriation bills that will spend beyond the level in House Bill 205 from the general fund will require another CBR vote. So it's in past years we've had some amount that could be done without another CBR vote, but this year we do not have that ability. So,
Representative Josephson.
Just real quickly through the chair, Mr. Painter, on the matter of election funding and CARES Act dollars, I know you're talking about something different than I'm about to ask, but I have some memory of hearing that the administration declined to accept some CARES Act money that it could have accepted, presumably during the April-May timeframe, relative to help with COVID impacts on elections. Is that, do you have some memory of that?
You know, I do not. I'm not sure if I was where I was at the time, but I do not. I can get back to you with more about that.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question. This is Representative Wall.
Representative Wall?
Sure. About the unspent CARES money, local governments, and I think some of them were required to only, I mean, not some of them, I think the rules were that they had to spend it on certain things directly related to COVID, and a lot of communities didn't have those direct expenses. There was talk that it could go back to the state and be reappropriated elsewhere. Would that be in violation of the RPLs? Also, as far as unspent COVID money in the federal government, are there many other states that have the same issue? And for that reason, could the deadline be extended or the restrictions loosened? And I know some of this is federal and we don't know. And I know the municipality of Anchorage had meetings with the federal government over buying a building, for example. So, you know, I know when they give all this money to these communities, not all of them had the direct expenses they could attribute to COVID. So I didn't know what was the sort of solution to that problem, because we don't want to, we want to keep as much of that money in Alaska as we can. And should it go back to a central holding that can then be redistributed, or do we need to pass new legislation to override the RPLs?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, that's a very good question about what exactly could be done through the RPL process. The RPL statute allows appropriations to be increased. There's no provision to allow appropriations to be decreased through the RPL process. So I'm not quite sure how that would play out if money is to be redistributed. There are some places in the budget, such as unemployment, where there's essentially open-ended federal receipt authority, so it's possible that the administration could just shift the funding. But I think you'd want to talk to legislative legal about the full ability to do that. I don't want to speculate on what could and couldn't be done just through the RPL process, because as we've seen, you know, there's some conflicting opinions about that. And in terms of what other states have experienced, the discussions I've heard in some conferences indicate that some states do have a lot of unspent money and others were able to spend it all very quickly. Part of that is because the formula had a floor of $1.25 billion that hit every state from, I think, Wyoming to Kansas in population. And so some of these states that are have populations many times the size of Alaska received the same amount of funding as we did. And so as a result, they, you know, they had much higher needs, and so the money went out very quickly. Some other states, I think it's been a little harder to spend it all. So there's a lot of variation in that. The last we had heard from on the federal level was that there was some interest in extending the deadline, but I can't speculate with any confidence about what Congress will do.
Yeah, thanks. I didn't expect that. I was just wondering if other states, and I've heard they're in a similar position, but the flat amount given to many states does explain a lot of it. Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, moving on to slide six, getting into the FY22 budget outlook. So to get to kind of look at next year, we're kind of adopting the Congressional Budget Office's methodology where they consider current law and current policy as potential baselines. On the federal level, sometimes there's a little less distinction, but here there can be a pretty big distinction because of our lack of dedicated funds. So the current law outlook assumes that we fully fund statutory obligations such as the statutory permanent fund dividend calculation, the full statutory funding of school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund, community assistance, and the oil tax credits. We're assuming the $40 million that the Department of Revenue mentioned for FY22. So the statutory permanent fund dividend in FY22 is projected to be about $2 billion, about $3,100 per recipient. And the other statewide items that were not funded in FY21 but are still on the books statutorily add up to about $174 million UGF in FY22. That's a pretty rough projection because we don't have, for example, the newer school debt projections and a couple of other things that may vary. The current policy outlook, on the other hand, assumes that in FY22 we would match FY21 and pay a dividend of roughly $1,000, and we would not fund school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund, community assistance beyond the amount coming from the PCE fund, or anything for oil tax credits. Both of these baselines assume that agency operations are flat in FY22, which, given that there's some natural increases in the budget each year, may necessitate some cuts to get there. And both of these use the revenue forecast that the Department of Revenue just presented right before this presentation.
Representative LeBond has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Painter, you mentioned school bond debt reimbursement to communities, REAA, and community assistance. What is the actual number that would be projected for the next fiscal year on that line item?
We can turn to the appendix slide we have at the end. It's slide 11 that gives the details of that. We estimate that the UGF portion of school debt bond debt reimbursement would be $82.6 million. That's assuming that about $15 million would come from the school fund, which is tobacco tax revenue. The REAA fund deposit we are projecting at about $34 million. That is a percentage of school debt reimbursement. Community assistance, we're projecting that based on the PCE earnings calculation, whereby a portion of PCE earnings can be used for the community assistance program, that about $12 million could come from the PCE program or from the PCE fund. And so the remaining amount to get up to a $30 million deposit would be about $17.6 million. And actually, with community assistance, you could assume a higher deposit because the statute has an or in there. that says you could either deposit $30 million or the amount needed to get up to a $90 million fund balance, which would be a bit higher. And then with oil tax credits, again, as I mentioned, that would be a $40 million assumption based on the Department of Revenue's numbers that they gave earlier today.
Yes, a quick follow-up, Madam Chair, if I may.
Follow-up.
So school debt, the state is helping a variety of school districts around the state with their bonded debt reimbursement. The number for the next fiscal year, again, is?
For unrestricted general funds, it's about $82.6 million, but that's an old projection. That's the projection from this spring. They don't have an updated projection. And then we're assuming that $15 million comes from the tobacco tax revenue, so just shy of $100 million in total funds, about $82.6 from that UGF.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll backtrack.
Please continue.
Yeah, so let's backtrack to slide 7, which shows the budget preview under current law. So these revenue figures on that first line are what Department of Revenue presented earlier. Agency operations, our baseline assumption is that they will be flat at $3.9 billion. The statewide items, matching that slide you just saw, would increase because several of those were unfunded in fiscal year 21. And then the capital budget we're assuming is more of a baseline, $150 million, which is sort of the average we've seen over the past 6 years, rather than the incomplete capital budget of about $120 million we had this year. And then we're putting in a placeholder for supplemental appropriations of $50 million. That may be conservative, but we don't want to go overboard on that, given that there's not any headroom this year. And then the dividend is about $2 billion. The result is a FY22 deficit of just over $2.4 billion. To put that number in context, that's about 36% of the total budget. And if you remove the dividend from that equation, it's just over half of the non-dividend budget. So without further revenue or major budget reductions, the baseline assumption going forward is a deficit that is about half of our budget, not including the dividend.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Wall.
Thank you. So, Mr. Payne, you're saying the deficit of $2.4 billion, if you remove the dividend, is half the budget. That would be about half the budget. But if you remove the dividend, then your budget goes down by quite a bit as well. So you would remove $2 billion on your permanent fund dividend line, so your deficit would be $0.4 billion roughly. So if you remove the dividend from one end, wouldn't you remove it from the other?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I guess I should have been a little more clear. So the governor's fiscal summary excludes the dividend from expenditures. So the governor's fiscal summary, the dividend does happen, but it's excluded. So if we pay a statutory dividend, the deficit would be equal to about half of the other expenditures. But yes, if you had no dividend, then the deficit would still be about $400 million.
Okay, so you're saying if you took the dividend out of the budget, but it was still an expenditure just on another other category, then the $2.4 billion would be half of the budget, and then you'd have another $2 billion outside of the budget, I guess is what you're saying.
Representative Wall, correct. That's how the governor's fiscal summary has portrayed it over the past couple of years.
Okay, so it's more of a bookkeeping thing. Thanks.
And I'm also including that just to give an idea of the scope of the problem. I think people often, you know, it's difficult to see what the deficit number means in scale. So just putting in 36% of the total budget or half of the non-dividend budget, I think, gives a sense of the scale of the deficit. Moving on to the current policy scenario, so everything's identical here except for the statewide items that dropped to $456.2 million because we're assuming that those items that were not funded in fiscal year 22 or fiscal year 21 continue to not be funded, and then the dividend reducing that to $680 million, which would pay a roughly $1,000 dividend again. And that leaves a deficit of $900 million, which is still greater than what's left in the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Moving on to slide 9, this is showing some fund balances that we have available to us. I mentioned the CBR balance already. Going into FY22, we are expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 million or a bit more to be available in the CBR. In the ERA, we expect about $11.7 billion to be available. And this is not including unrealized gains, as they have to be realized before they're spendable. And so this, we've heard some various numbers for the ERA balance that's available. This is the amount that's available or projected to be available on the first day of the fiscal year, of fiscal year 22, before any POMV draw in FY22 and before any earnings come in. So this is just the starting point. Sometimes people take out the POMV draw but don't count the earnings or something like that, and you get different numbers. But this is just the number that's in the history and projection sheet that the Permanent Fund Corporation produces. And then we have an additional...
Representative Lebon?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Painter, if I could go back up to the on slide 9, the reference to the Constitutional Budget Reserve dollar amount of about $587 million. When you reference on the top of that column that this is a balance that would be available in fiscal year 22, is this taken into an account that the CBR would have a working capital cushion that is untouchable, say $1 billion, which in my mind would be about the floor of a working capital amount for the state. Is that correct?
Representative LeBlanc, through the chair, no, that working capital is available for appropriation. If we fully expend the CBR down to zero, we have other cash options that are just more costly, such as the ERA. So essentially after this fiscal year, we will not have anything available in the CBR beyond the amount that's used for cash flow, but we could still draw that. It would just result in having to turn to higher earnings savings accounts or other accounts in order to meet that cash flow need. So we've already passed the point, essentially, where we could keep $1 billion in the CBR because we already have less than that.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. Painter, when you have the ERA at 11.7, that is including the unrealized gains, right?
No, it is excluding the unrealized gains. So 11.7 is just the spendable cash amount that's projected to be in the ERA on June 30th of this fiscal year.
Okay. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Painter, the number the Permanent Fund Corporation uses now is 10.3 or 10.5. So are you projecting earnings over the next, I guess, 9 months of $1.2 billion?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, this is the number that the Permanent Fund Corporation is projecting for the remainder of the fiscal year. And so the earnings, the realized earnings so far, I think have been a little higher than the pace of their total year forecast. But this is based on their projections. the amount that would be available at the end of this fiscal year with the remaining earnings. Thanks. And so the last item on this slide is the list of is the balance in funds that the administration identifies as sweepable. I know there are some in the legislature who disagree with some of the funds that are on that list, but you know, that the administration is the one that conducts the sweep, so that's sort of the default, although the legislature could contest that if it happened. And there's approximately $1.5 billion in sweepable funds. The vast majority of that is held in the PCE fund and the higher education fund, which are funds that were not considered sweepable until the last couple of years, so there's relatively little in the other funds remaining. So those funds plus the CBR are not quite sufficient to balance the budget in FY22 under the current law scenario. So absent action by the legislature to reduce the budget or add new revenue in some way, based on that current law scenario, we would expect that other sources would have to be found even beyond those two. And that's all I have. So,
are there any other questions?
If I could jump in, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Lebon.
Yes, on the thank you. On the last slide, number 11, there's reference made to the school bond debt reimbursement at $82 million and the REAA fund deposit at $33 million. Could you explain how those two are connected and how one is dependent upon the other?
Representative Lebon, through the chair, yes. So the REAA fund deposit in statute is linked. There's a calculation that is complicated, and I can't even begin to understand it, about essentially the linking the student count in REAAs versus organized areas and giving a percentage of the amount of bond debt reimbursement accrued in organized areas into the REAA fund that can then be used by the unorganized areas or used by the department to fund school construction and maintenance in the unorganized borough. And so one thing I'll emphasize on that is that over the past few years, when there have been vetoes or reductions to school debt reimbursement, there has also been a corresponding reduction generally to the REAA fund deposit because they're linked in statute. But the consent decree that created the REAA fund found that this school construction is a state responsibility regardless of what happens elsewhere, because these areas don't have the ability to raise their own funds through bonding. And so even if we just zeroed out school debt reimbursement going forward, we would not be in compliance with that order if we also zeroed out the REAA fund going forward. So it's certainly a legally risky place to be to keep reducing the REAA fund deposit, regardless of what we want to do with school debt reimbursement, even though there is a statutory linkage between the two.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Peter, on the question of the sweepable funds, we saw that that Mr. Ferreira was successful in stopping a broader interpretation of what the authority to bond is. It's my understanding, and my office is doing a very deep analysis of this right now. I spent about 5 hours myself reading Hickel versus Cooper recently. Because I was really struck by the hearings that occurred on the Senate side in July 2019 about the differences of opinion between the administration and the Legislative Finance Division about what's sweepable. And I mentioned the Ferrer case because if the PCE were swept, there could be litigation about that, could there not, in that it's part of the Alaska Energy Authority and it's unclear in Hickle versus Cooper what the court would make of that. And I guess where I'm going with this is we shouldn't assume that at all that that's available to us to spend without some pushback.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yeah, the sweepable funds statute that we passed in the 90s was found unconstitutional in Hickle v. Cooper, so we really don't have statutory guidance to go off of. And the fact that the Supreme Court considered, I think it is probably ambiguous exactly how they would rule on a case like that. You know, and you could argue further that the sweepable list that we have now is not big enough, that because we draw from the ERA for general government, the ERA should also be considered sweepable. That, again, has not been tested. It's unclear how the courts would rule, and I don't know. I mean, we can speculate about how the courts might rule, but there's significant uncertainty about what exactly is sweepable because the Supreme Court invalidated our statutes on it and no replacements have been made for those statutes.
Representative Mayer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Painter, can you just remind me what the average rate of return for the PCE fund is?
Representative Merrick, through the chair, it is the last projection I saw was 6.2% going forward. I have not looked to see if they have an updated projection, but generally the DOR funds, the funds managed by the Department of Revenue, return at a fairly similar rate to the permanent fund over the long term. So that one and the higher ed fund, I think, were both projected to be 6.2% as of the last time I looked.
Thank you very much.
And a follow-up to that, I think the actuals for both have been very similar to the permanent fund, which this year was 2%. Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question, and it's the last line item on that chart on page 11, oil and gas tax credits. That $40 million, that's the minimum payment that would be required in fiscal year 22 related to the approximately $743 million obligation on the tax credits that remain unpaid?
Representative Vaughn, correct. That is, through the chair, that's correct. That is the statutory calculation for the deposit. We could deposit more or less. It's subject to appropriation, but that is the statutory calculation.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Hearing no further questions, I want to thank all the presenters today and committee members for participating. With no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 12:10.